The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to week 30 of, the Bitchery of History.
I'm Allison.
And my name's Max. And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Annie Jump Cannon.
Ooh, yeah. I don't know anything. I'm excited.
You do know a little something because her work ties directly into Cecilia Payne's work.
Oh.
Who was the very first woman I ever did on the Bitchery of History.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I am doing Flora Saunders.
Okay.
Who is another World War veteran
of awesomeness.
Because I keep finding them and I'm in love with it.
Please,
so I'm not going to
stop. Them.
So this is World War I, actually. So Flora was born on January 22nd, 1876 in Yorkshire, England.
Ooh.
She was the youngest daughter of an Irish family, and then the family moved to Suffolk when she was 9. And most girls her age at that time were probably, you know, sewing, playing with dolls. Mm-hmm. It was still, I mean, this is before even the turn of the...
Right. This is way before 19th first century. Wave feminism.
Exactly. So they're all just usually content to sit around. But she decided to not do that and follow her two favorite pursuits, horse riding and shooting.
Yes.
She wished that she had been born a boy. She dreamed of becoming a soldier. So when she was 18, Flora trained as a stenographer in London and used her secretarial skills, plus a legacy from a rich uncle, to go traveling. So she decided to go work in Cairo, then British Columbia, and then she traveled across the U.S., where reportedly she shot a man in self-defense.
Oh.
However, there is very little you can find out about this story. All the story is that she shot a man in self-defense. Don't know defending from
Dang.
What, don't know if the man
yeah.
died, don't know anything, but, oh yeah, oh, Flora, oh yeah, she shot a man in self-defense.
She
That's all
man.
We need to know.
Right.
So, she joined a shooting club, and then mm-hmm. she trained with the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry. So, by 1914, Flora was actually 38 years old.
What's a yeoman?
A yeoman? It's like a knighthood kind of a thing, I believe.
Oh.
Can you check
it? Yeah. Yeoman. According to Google, it's a servant. Of course I Googled it. Yeoman. According to Google, it's a servant in a royal or noble household ranking between a sergeant and a groom or a squire and a page.
So there you go. I knew it was something with knights.
Right.
I was pretty
yeah,
on point.
Yeah, you were right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you know how I know that?
Why?
Harry Potter.
Yes.
And Sir Cadogan.
So Sir Cadogan.
Oh.
Aww.
Poor Sir Cadogan. Oh. Didn't make it in the movies. Wah, wah.
Oh, no. He was there for a second.
Yeah, but
when
like
they first
not
go
for real.
Oh, yeah, no. Mm-mm.
So in any case, mm-hmm. by 1914, Flora's 38. She's living at home, and she was considered very unladylike. She wore short hair. She cared nothing for housework. Did not keep up appearances at
same,
all.
Same. Well, not same on the last one.
So when World War I broke out, Flora saw a chance. She joined a St. John ambulance unit to aid the humanitarian crisis that was developing in Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrived on the front line of Serbia's fight against the Austro-Hungarian offensive.
Mm-hmm.
She worked in military hospitals, tending Serbian wounded. Initially, she talked to them just kind of through signing, like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
What's going on? And then she eventually got so fluent in Serbian that it was good enough for her to join the Serbian Red Cross and work in an ambulance for the 2nd Infantry Regiment of the
wow.
Serbian Army. The 2nd Regiment was known as the Iron Regiment and
nice.
Spent most of its time in the front line. By this stage of the war, it was going really pretty badly for the Serbian Army.
Mm-hmm.
It was slowly being driven back by just overwhelming odds, just
yeah.
by sheer numbers. It was really not.
Poor Serbia.
Not so great for them. Their only line of retreat was through the Albanian mountains,
mm-hmm.
and conditions were so bad that Flora kind of drifted between being a nurse and a soldier and a nurse and a soldier. When her unit reached a country impassable to ambulances, she took the Red Cross badge off her arm and declared that she would join the 2nd Regiment as a private.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love it.
Flora's enlistment in the field was simple. The colonel of the regiment just took his small brass regimental badges off his own jacket and fastened them onto her shoulders. And was just like, okay, great, you'll join?
Sure, thanks.
We'll take you.
Yep.
Welcome. Welcome aboard.
Yeah.
So the Balkans have a tradition of sworn virgins, so it was not really unusual for women to serve in the Serbian army. But Flora was the only British woman to do so.
Oh.
She was regarded as a considerable asset by her Serbian comrades.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at her as almost a representation of England personified, because England had pledged that they would help them.
Right.
And here is this British woman helping them. So she was highly, highly revered in the Serbian army. She continued fighting across the Macedonian front, and she further distinguished herself in combat, being promoted to the rank of sergeant major within the year.
Dang.
So she wrote many letters home. She published a book, convinced the British government to buy new uniforms to replace the really ruined uniforms that the Serbian army was wearing. And back in England, she became known as a heroine to women across the country, just kind of for how women could go, you know what? Forget sewing. I'm going to go bayonet some people on the Serbian front. BRB. After several months of intense combat, she was seriously wounded while charging Bulgarian infantry positions outside the Macedonian town of Monastir.
Mm-hmm.
The 40-year-old Flora was critically wounded by a grenade while she was involved in hand-to-hand combat fighting over a strategically critical hill.
Oh.
Yet, she did not let that stop her from contributing to the war effort. As soon as she was able to stand up from her hospital bed, because obviously she had to take some time off once you have a run-in with a grenade, you have to take a nap for a little bit of time.
Even if it's forced.
Right. So she started working as a nurse again, and once she was back to her full strength, she just went back to her old unit. However, by this point, the war was over. So she went back and rejoined her unit, even though the war was over. But in June 1919, an act of the Serbian parliament officially made her the first woman ever to be commissioned an officer in the Serbian military.
Nice.
She also received the King George Star, the highest military honor
That's
offered.
That's two women in a row for you with that.
Well, the King George Star, this one is from the Serbian government.
Oh, okay.
And it's their highest military offer.
Oh. Fantastic.
So there you go. She was given command of her own platoon and would go out and work with them every day, all the recruits, you know, marching with them. She eventually retired as a captain. She continued living in Serbia, though she was less excited about just kind of chilling when she had more fun riding around and shooting people. When she turned 51, she married a Russian general who had fought against the communists, and she loved her Serbian home so much that she did not evacuate Serbia when the Nazis came through in World War II. The Gestapo came by and interrogated her a couple of times because they were the Gestapo, and they thought she must know something. She fought back against them pretty vehemently, and they let it go. After her husband died, Flora returned to England. She went on a tour across the world talking about her experiences and how awesome it was when she bayoneted someone to death at close range.
She would talk about that?
Apparently.
Dang.
She died in Suffolk in 1956.
She just walked around town. Yeah, I stabbed a guy.
My favorite part, though, is I'm a nurse. We're under heavy fire. We're trying to get through these mountains. You know, I'm in mortal danger.
Right.
I'm going to die here. You know what I should do? Join the army.
Right, gun please. I mean, at that point, it's just logical. At that point, you're just making the, like,
how should I survive? I should get a gun.
Right. Oh, it's me or them?
Them.
Okay. Bye.
So that is the amazing Flora.
What an amazing woman.
Love it.
What's great is that we've chose two women who really excelled in what were men's worlds and actively had men like working against them or working against their own interests.
Right.
So Annie Jump Cannon was born on December 11th, 1863 in Dover, Delaware. She's the oldest of three, born to a mother and a father who, her father was a state senator, as well as an amateur scientist. And her mother really encouraged, it was her mother who encouraged her and her sisters to pursue their studies in mathematics, chemistry and biology. And really, it said that Annie had a makeshift astronomy set up like in her attic, and she would stay up. I mean, she didn't have a telescope or anything, but she would like sit. It was all dark so that she could look out at the stars, and she would have little maps and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And she was already, as a little girl, kind of mapping where things were. And it said that her father would stay up all night because he was worried that the candle she was using was going to burn down their house.
Aww. Shout out to all the dads out there.
Yes.
Just makes me think one time I wanted to cover myself in mud from head to foot. And my dad just looked at me. I'm already halfway soaked in mud. And he goes, you know what? Just let me hose you off before you come inside.
Right. Yeah.
It's one of the best days of my life. I remember it.
I bet.
And to now.
Absolutely. Back to Annie Jumpcannon.
Yeah, I'm on it. I'm on board.
Back to Annie Jumpcannon. She goes to Wellesley College in 1880, and she studies physics and astronomy. And then she becomes a special student at this place called Radcliffe, a school called Radcliffe, which had a sister school in Harvard University.
Okay, yeah.
And so she goes there to use her work in physics and astronomy and becomes part of this group of women at the Harvard College Observatory that was put together by this man named Edward Pickering. And he brought together a bunch of women because he was looking for a bunch of unskilled labor, essentially, that he could teach what to do. He hired people who knew science, women who knew science, so that they could be in there to help lead and direct. The official name, or the name that Edward liked to call them, were the Harvard Computers. The kind of derogatory name that they used was either the Pickering Harem or Pickering's Girls.
Nope.
And these are fully grown women.
Nope.
Right?
Just no.
So the great work that Cannon got into was going through these pictures of the night sky and classifying the stars. And Pickering was doing his research in the way that, okay, I'm not really sure what I'm looking for. I know that we want to study spectral classifications, and there had been a system already for classifying stars. And so he said, you know what? Let's just take as many measurements as is humanly possible.
Great.
And so that's why he got all these women together. In her lifetime, she ends up being in this position for more than 40 years.
Wow.
And some estimates put the number of stars that she personally cataloged at more than 400,000.
Holy cow.
Over 40 years. That's 10,000 stars a year.
I need to take a nap.
Right? And so she could do it. It said that her eye was really special because she could just look at a star and someone would be sitting there taking notes and she'd just say, oh, this is a G class 2 or this is a B2 or this is a O4.
Wow.
Right? So you could just look at it and see. And all of this work that she does comes into what Cecilia Payne comes in because she sets up this classification system. And the classification system is what we still use to this day. There are 7 types of stars in terms of heat.
Right.
And it goes O, B, A, F, G, K, M. And now these letters at first were completely, they were based on the older classification system.
Okay.
But they weren't really set in any one place.
Right, right.
Because they're taking all of this data.
Right.
It's more like, let's find as much as we can.
Right.
But what she ends up doing is in classifying these stars. So for example, the sun is a type G star, which is a mid-range star.
Right.
Sirius, which is the brightest star in our sky, is a type A star.
Okay.
Which means it's 2 steps brighter than our sun.
Okay.
And why this is important is because, like we talked about in that first episode with Cecilia Payne, by doing this fine detail work, we were able to find different stars are all made up of the same thing. And so what that means is that now when we look into space, we can look at what color a star is, or we can look at its spectrum and see what kind it is. And we can know how hot it is, which means we know if it's going to nova, if it's going to supernova, hypernova, like what the lifespan of it's going to become, which means that only certain types of stars will have life around them. It narrows down where we can look for life in the universe.
Cool.
It narrows down where we can like go for future space missions.
Ooh,
we use it to point telescopes in different ways so that we can study different stars.
Okay.
She found these things called variable stars, which change light depending on time, or they change at different variables. And a lot of these quote-unquote variable stars have gone on through further study to become things like binary star systems, which are two stars locked in gravity.
Whoa, it's Tatooine! Spinning around.
It's Tatooine,
oh
yeah.
Oh my god, I'm in love.
So we find double star systems, we find white dwarfs, we find brown dwarfs eventually because of her work. It's because we can look at something that far away and say, we know what the spectrum is.
Right.
Right?
That's amazing.
And that's all from Annie Jump Cannon. In her life, she received many awards. In 1921, she received an honorary doctorate from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. She became the first woman recipient of an honorary doctorate from Oxford University in 1925. Received an honorary degree from Oglethorpe in 1935. In 1929, she was listed as one of the 12 greatest living women from the National League of Women's Voters.
Wow.
1932, she wins the Ellen Richards Prize from the Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women.
Wow.
The first woman elected as an officer to the American Astronomical Society, a society to which she had to receive honorary membership into in the first place because at the time, women were not allowed in.
Ugh.
Right? She has a crater on the moon named after her. It's named Cannon. There's an asteroid named after her. I was reading one article about her, and it was talking about her doing theoretical stellar work, which is now classified as astrophysics.
Wow.
So she was on the ground floor of creating an entire new...
It's awesome.
...arm of science.
It's fantastic. I love it.
I love her. Two last notes. The first, when she first got to Harvard, she started the work and then she started suffering from frequent ear infections, which left her almost completely deaf for the rest of her life. So she was doing all of this work and being almost completely deaf. The second two is going to come later in Today in History because one of our Todays in History ties in.
Okay.
I figured, I felt last week I did a double feature. This week I should complete the double feature from the first episode of our podcast.
Perfect.
There we go. We'd like to take a minute to talk to you about our partners at audible.com.
You can start a free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/vitri. If you are interested in the life of Flora Saunders that I brought up, you can check out a book about her on Audible. It's called A Fine Brother, The Life of Captain Flora Saunders, and it is by Louise Miller.
Fantastic.
So check that out. It's free with a 30-day trial.
Yes, you can get it at audibletrial.com/bitchery. All right, so Today in History.
Yes, indeed.
All righty. August 23rd, 1838, the first class graduated from Mount Holyoke Female Seminary.
Ooh.
And this is where Annie Jump Cannon ties in, because Mount Holyoke was the first member of the Seven Sister Colleges, which is seven sister colleges throughout New England.
Mm-hmm, generally.
Which are all traditionally female colleges.
Right.
Two others of those seven sisters are Wellesley and Radcliffe, where Annie Jump Cannon received her education.
Oh, fantastic. On August 23rd, 1850, the first National Women's Rights Convention in the U.S. convened in Worcester, Massachusetts.
And then on August 25th, 1908, the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses was founded.
Interesting. Yeah,
using the term of the time.
Yes, of course.
So this week, I thought instead of doing a term to define, we should have a conversation to talk about.
The conversation that I decided we should talk about is actually, it's kind of a hot button issue.
I agree.
On any side of the table that you're on, but particularly when you're a feminist, and that is who pays for dates?
Who pays for dates? And this is also a question which is broadened from just men and women as we start the larger conversation on queer rights in America as well.
So here is my opinion.
Okay.
Whoever asks out pays. It's so easy.
Oh my God.
It's
I love
so
it.
So easy.
That's it. Okay, we'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, exactly. It's so easy. Now, because men traditionally still ask out women, that means that men are typically paying. I will say as someone who has not been on very many dates, as you are likely aware, Max Kirkham, and you,
I mean, I haven't
dear
either,
listeners,
so.
are not. There was one person I went on 3 dates with. He asked me out the first time. Mm-hmm. He paid the first time.
Right.
The second time, I said, no, you paid the first time. I'll pay.
Right.
We have equally paying jobs.
Right.
Roughly. And then the last time that we went out, the third time, he paid again. So It started out with him. And then to me, I just wouldn't feel comfortable.
Absolutely.
I always offered to split or like pay for whatever I've gotten. Here's where it gets tricky though, is if someone has asked me out and then they don't offer to pay, that feels like a slap in the face.
Yeah, I hear that. At least to pay for their own stuff.
Oh, no. It's not, I don't pay for theirs, but we pay separately. And then it gets into this weird,
okay.
Like someone's like, hey, let's go on a date. And I'll say, okay, great. Let's go get some coffee. And
sure.
Then we buy separate coffees. I'm like, are we on a date or are we just...
Are we in a meeting?
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear that. It's interesting because as far as I know, because I've been on dates, I mean, primarily with men.
Right.
And so you get into it and there is usually this awkward, like, should we split it? No, I got it. Usually it's like, at least the way it kind of works with me, it's been like, oh, I'm going to go to the bathroom real quick. And if they don't like put their card down by the time I'm back, usually I'll put mine down. Just like, it's like a thing. But sometimes you get into, because for some reason we still have to have this conversation of, oh, in a male on male relationship or a female on female relationship, who's the man?
Right.
Who's the woman? And it's like, well, then, that person pays or that person pays. And I agree. It's like,
it should be equal.
We should be equal. But I really like your suggestion.
Well, that's, to me, always makes the most sense.
Absolutely.
And because typically in a heterosexual relationship, particularly at the beginning, the man has asked out, the man should pay. If, however, you are a strong, independent woman and you ask someone else, more power to you,
right. But
you should pay.
Right.
And then after that first date, in my opinion, it should evenly split, although that's probably always going to be weird. It should just go back and forth.
I think if
like,
you treated last time, I'll treat this time.
You know, you paid for the movie tickets, I'll pay for dinner afterward. It should just be equal.
At that point, it's more like, okay, well, you asked me out, so like you initiated this. We're getting to a second date. Oh, it's my turn to see if this is going to go.
Because here's the thing where it comes in where it's a little bit annoying if someone asks you out and then doesn't pay, is then it feels like, what are you investing in this?
True.
Almost literally.
Sure.
Are you willing to invest a little bit of money in me or no?
Or is this a sign that the date didn't go as well as you thought it would go?
Right. Or whatever
it
may be. So if there's a second date and we're both agreeing to invest more time in each other, then I would also be willing to invest financially in that.
Sure. I would say at a certain point, if you're getting to a second date, you're probably able to talk to each other enough to the point where you can have the discussion about it at that point.
Yeah, or just
you
when
can
it comes
have
time
the,
to pay,
you
just,
can feel it out.
Just be like, no, you paid last time, I'll pay this time. But I think it should be as simple as that. Whoever asks out should pay.
Works for me.
Well, thanks for joining us as
Thank
we
you
solve
so much.
The problems of
yeah.
the world.
One at a time. One at a time.
I'm Allison.
I'm Max, and if you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can do that on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/umpboh.
We are also on Twitter and Instagram at the same handle, at umpboh.
You can also visit our brand new website at umpboh.com.
It's beautiful. Oh. I cried when I saw it.
Our intern, Katie Chang, put it together.
It's amazing.
Yes, it was your birthday present, wasn't it?
It was the best birthday present I ever got in my life.
Your very own website.
Aww. You can also keep in touch with us and help us keep amazing things going on, like our website, by supporting us on Patreon. We are at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. That only costs like a few cents a day.
Nothing.
A few bucks a month. Cost of a latte.
The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions with your hosts, Max Kirkham.
And Allison Powell.
Intern Katie Chang.
Associate producer Chris McNeil.
And contributors Grace Seaman, Ella Moore, and Kelsey Shea.
Ursula Major Productions also brings you Shaky Understanding, which you can check out on iTunes, hosted again by myself and the fantastic Beverly Jean.
I gotta tell you, I listen every week, I mean, obviously, and I love it. As an avid Shakespeare lover, it's great to have that dichotomy between you two.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. So that's the newest podcast in the Ursula Major Network.
Love it.
Love it. And as always, bitches get stuff done. Hey, y'all. If you're enjoying the podcast, we would be so grateful if you would go to whatever platform you're listening on and leave us a rating or a comment. Those ratings and comments help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks.